Hasami, 2 weeks ago, President Obama held an international summit here in Washington, and it was on Muslim entrepreneurship. More than 200 people came from over 60 countries. They connected with experts, with government officials, with business leaders, and with citizens. You were there. Can you tell us what it was like, what you learned, what was surprising to you about the summit?
Honestly, it was the most surprising thing I could say was that given how advanced our society and world are at this time and age, the fact that people found the concept of the summit to be so revolutionary was shocking to me. I don't see things like the summit and like the initiatives that the Obama administration is doing as luxury, but actually as necessity. And so I think that it's important that people are now engaging on numerous levels, as you mentioned, the government officials, business leaders, citizens, active grassroots leaders. And this allows for this type of initiative to actually have fruitful outcomes. But I think that we need to move past this idea that this is luxury and, you know, side to kind of head-on diplomacy, but rather see this type of initiative as instrumental to actually advancing things like national security, global international connectivity, and that sort of thing. So I think that was one of my biggest takeaways, was that the hype around this type of thing, and then you've heard terms like historic and revolutionary. And I do think that it is a requirement in order to start engaging in this type of thing, in order to have fruitful international engagement and collaborative kind of world peace. And I brought this up actually at the event that we put together on the 29th, which was a independent but related event to the summit. I quoted Eleanor Roosevelt, who said that the structure of world peace cannot be the work of one man, one party, or one nation. It must be a peace which rests on cooperative effort of the world. And I think that says it all.
Wow, thank you for that. Let me just follow up on that a little bit. In terms of your view of the summit as a necessity and the kind of connectivity that needs to happen, how would you rate what happened those 2 days? Was it a success? Was it a beginning? What was going on? What was it like? And how much did it line up with what you see as important?
I did not start in a lot of the summit. I went to a few receptions, and I went to the opening event, and I also went to wrap-up events because I also work full-time in D.C., but I think that in the opportunity that I had to engage with summit delegates, both at the summit and then outside of the summit, because that was a central part of the summit also, which I did really applaud the administration for, it was as important to the administration to engage these summit delegates with the government as it was to engage them with the local American companies, entities, organizations, institutions. And I think that in and of itself was one of the most powerful parts of the summit. But it extended beyond merely the outreach of the summit delegates to the administration and vice versa, but it really encouraged summit delegates to, A, take ownership and really reach beyond trying to make something of their time here, but also encouraging nonprofits, encouraging institutions, encouraging think tanks to actually also put in effort and time and resources to host events for the summit delegates. So I think that the most empowering thing that I found out of having talked to the summit delegates of their experiences was that ability for them to see not only what the American government was doing, but also, A, the support of the American people of the initiatives that their government are taking part in, but that also is very important to what we did specifically and for what I do, is for these delegates to see the support of the Muslim American community and the Arab American community of our administration. Because it's one thing to feel like it's lack of connectivity. You know, you look at America as this monolithic thing, and that's a two-way street. I mean, that, as Arabs and Muslims, we always say the Arab world looks, you know, America looks at the Arab world as this monolithic Arab world, and we're so diverse. And I think it's very important to note that it also happens the other way around. When Arab communities talk about America, it's this monolithic America, and we know that that's not the reality. So I think that was one of the most powerful things of the summit that came out of it. And I think it really affected the summit delegates on a personal level, which made their takeaway much larger than merely just coming to engage in workshops, but they actually got to meet, interact with Arab Americans and with Muslim Americans, who not only said it's important for us also here to build connectivity with other Muslim and Arab communities around the world, but then also for us to show our support for things like the summit and other initiatives of the administration.
You know, holding a summit per se is not that unusual. But the big focus was on entrepreneurship, and that word was used a lot, both business entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs. Why do you think that was the focus, entrepreneurship? Why was that key and particular about this particular summit?
I think that the term entrepreneurship in and of itself, I mean, also, I must say, in an Arab context, entrepreneurship is important because we believe in kind of personal integrity, personal ownership. It's a pride of your country. It's a pride of your heritage. You hear these terms like pride and dignity and homeland. Well, what do those actually mean when you translate them into action? And I think entrepreneurship is, in and of itself, really a way of bringing together these feelings and these connections and these deep kind of identity. I call them identity words, like, you know, dignity. I mean, you hear that a lot in the Arab community, but what does that actually mean? And so when you look at a lot of the activities that these summit delegates that came, you know, they are entrepreneurs in that they are channeling their feelings, their visions, their hopes, their aspirations into action that not only change the landscape in which they live, but also have longer-term effect, like the ripple effect. I mean, one action of one person in a little city in Halab in Syria can affect, in turn, you know, inspiring someone else in Latakia to also engage. And then you build this kind of network of people who share visions and hope and aspirations for a healthier society and healthier community. And I really found that that was the theme and of most of the discussion around the summit and entrepreneurship as it relates to kind of this idea of global cooperation. It was, what do each of these individual people do, actively do, and actively engage in, and are self-motivated? I think that's also a key word. How are they self-motivated to take ownership of their problems or their, quote-unquote, perceived problems, and channel it into something constructive rather than just merely sitting around talking about it? And I think that is, in essence, the core of entrepreneurship as it relates to kind of empowering people to take action. And business, as it relates to that, I mean, they've created business opportunities for people. And not only did that create something for that person to do, but then they could also engage other people who shared similar views, who shared similar work fields in building something much larger.
I want to ask you about a new organization that you recently created, the Al Mubadara Arab Empowerment Initiative. Can you tell us why you started it and tell us a little bit about what it does?
Wonderful. I have actually, the past few years, I've been working on public and cultural diplomacy, international kind of diplomatic affairs. My personal interest has stemmed from this idea of how can you create opportunities and avenues to engage in larger discussions about kind of international affairs that preach beyond the choir, that engage non-traditional stakeholders, that engage in non-traditional diplomacy. And I think previously non-traditional diplomacy was seen as froofy. I mean, it was government to government and everything else was just fluff that did not have much emphasis, like cultural diplomacy, diplomacy of the arts, space diplomacy, business diplomacy. And I think increasingly there's been a shift towards trying to figure out how to engage people that are not the people that ordinarily would come to the table, because we realize that that doesn't really accomplish much. There's a lot of talking, but not much action. And if there is much action, it's still creating this bigger divide. I mean, you have people who care and then people who simply don't. So how can you bridge those two gaps, and then how can you create that type of a dialogue that engages people beyond just the quote-unquote, as we call them, the kumbaya discussions? And so that's what fuels me in the work I do and what gave birth to the idea of creating an organization called Al Mubadara. So Al Mubadara is an Arabic word that means the act of taking initiative. And that is something that, again, ties not only into my work, my larger work, but also my vision for what it would take to reach a level of development, sustainable development, and a healthier community and viable community in the Arab world. And I, as a person, as an Arab who has lived in the United States and all around the world, you know, every time I return back to the Middle East, and I must say this was very much built on a personal narrative and my personal vision and that of my partner, which stems from our frustrations with the situations and then taking blame for them, partially. And again, this came from a discussion my colleague and I were having at an event. And, you know, we're saying, you know, it's just so shocking to see the state that the Arab world is currently in, the lack of hope, the growing socioeconomic gaps, the growing generational gaps, the lack of connectivity, and also, I think more importantly, this idea that we feel like, oh, well, a poor, you know, Arab communities, look how bad the situations are, yet we are Arabs living all around the world who are not really doing anything to contribute to that situation or to help the situation. So in essence, my colleague Victor Shibley and I said, you know, we, in not doing something, we are part of this problem. We have capacity, we have the ability, we have the resources, we have the intent, and we have the luxury of actually doing something, and in sitting here talking about it, we're actually fueling the problem. So that literally, that concept and that idea of self-empowerment gave birth to Al-Mubadara, and this, we really wanted to figure out how we can create international, global connectivity between diaspora Arab communities to re-engage and reinvest into the Arab world, and which aims to do a few things. I mean, ultimately, it aims to strengthen global Arab communities, and it also aims to bridge the gap, the growing gap, between Arabs who are not fortunate enough to leave the Arab world, Arabs who want to stay in the Arab world to help the Arab world, but then also the brain drain issue, which is a really large issue and a crippling issue as we see it.
I know that the organization is still brand new, and so you're still looking forward to things that you hope to do. So can you give us just some particulars of what you're planning and what you're hoping to do?
Yeah, well, two projects for Al-Mubadara. We're trying to create an independent, non-political, and I stress the term non-political, a multicultural, multi-religious initiative that is devoted to developing a global platform for engagement. And by that, I mean we're really trying to work with global diaspora Arab communities to build a multi-level and multidisciplinary approach to development and civic engagement in the region, which, again, really addresses the issues of brain drain and emigration of human capacity from the Arab world, but then also building intra-cultural, sustainable, and strategic collaborations and partnerships. And we're doing that through two main projects. Number one is a reverse brain drain project that really, we looked at a sustainable model that have worked in other communities, and Teach for America and Indicor were the two main models that we looked at as being able to be successful throughout the Arab world. So it's taking professionals and engaging them for specific durations of time that are short into the Arab world to, A, help strengthen the fields, the career fields in which they're being engaged in, but then also really showcasing the talent that exists in the Arab community around the world that is not really recognized. The second project, which is more about building capacity building and community resource development in the Arab world, we've called Acts of Faith. And what Acts of Faith is, it's going to be a community service platform that we have taken the model of something like serve.gov, which was by the Obama administration, and we've applied something very similar to the Arab world. And I say all of this to say that there are a lot of initiatives that are currently taking place. And we should definitely not say that this does not exist today. But there's a lack of connectivity and a lack of knowledge about what's taking place, who's engaging in what, and there's not an overarching umbrella that people, you know, who are interested in one thing can link into the work of another. That currently does not really exist. And so that's what we're aiming to do, is to create an umbrella type of entity that engages all these different people, but then also encourages the engagement of people who don't necessarily see a place or have not yet found a place for themselves to have a voice in this. And that really brings home the main point that this is an initiative for the Arab community, by the Arab community, and for the collective well-being of the Arab world. And that's ultimately how we see it.
Let's just shift and talk about the American Muslim and American Arab community here in the United States. You've said many times that this is a very diverse community, and even to use the word community in the singular is probably not that accurate because it's many, many communities. Can you talk a little bit about the diversity here in the United States and what it looks like?
I think that I refer to the Muslim identity as something that is not this monolithic thing. And a lot of my work aims to actually address that specifically, but not through talking about it, but through putting a face to it. And I always use the term putting a face to in a lot of the work that I do, because I think that is, in essence, what we need to do. We need to say this is not one Muslim. This is not what a Muslim looks like, because, in essence, Islam is a faith. It is something that's internal. It's a relationship. It's a mindset. It's a worldview. So how can you physically and externally identify what a Muslim is without familiarity with that person on a personal level? Because it's a very personal relationship with your Creator. So with that said, that what I try to do is to show that. It's to acknowledge that Islam, like any other faith or practice, is influenced by many things, including interpretation, political climate, like social cultural variations. And in essence, all of these things shape the flavors or colors, as I call them, of the practice of Islam. And I think it's really important also in the work that I do to show that not that, that Islam as a faith should be separated from Muslims as followers of that faith. We often use the term Muslim and Islam interchangeably. And I think it's really important to not just collectively describe the actions of Muslims as the way Islam functions, because there's so many different actions that people partake in that not necessarily, it may not be derived, or according to their interpretation, are derived from the faith, but they do not, you know, own, I guess, the overall faith in a way, if I can actually use that expression. So I think that the one thing that's really important and also showcasing the face of the community is that there's a lot of misconceptions and stereotypes that are built into what a Muslim looks like. And I personally, as a woman who's very active in the Arab and Muslim community, who is non-veiled, who does not quote-unquote look Muslim, and I get that all the time, and I've never really known what that meant. But I think, you know, I'm not dark-complected. I am tall, a lot taller than most, quote-unquote, what most Muslims look like. And that makes absolutely no sense to me, because there are Muslims of all shapes and ethnicities. The conversion rate is really large. So how do you move beyond this idea that there is a face of a Muslim or a face of Islam? And that's the type of work that I do, and really try to showcase on a personal level that appreciation for the beauty, unique creation, individualism, and depth of Muslims as individuals, which is oftentimes stripped out of how we define Muslims in mainstream America. And I think that that also engages and ignites larger dialogue in the community. Because once you start seeing the many faces of those who identify, self-identify as Muslims, then you can no longer say Muslims are X, because you have a pool of people who all identify the same way but look so different, talk so different, act so different, interact so differently. So in essence, what is Islam? What is the face of Islam? And so you have to look at the faces versus the face. So it's mainly about changing the paradigm. And I think once we change the paradigm, we will start to then see the multi-disciplinary levels of engagement of Muslim American communities, but also the depth of the experience of Muslim American communities. And then also it provides an opportunity for Muslim Americans to kind of create a place where they can define themselves versus constantly being defined by other people and by what exists beyond them.
I think you're exactly right. And that is a great challenge. Just in terms, as you say, of people's preconceptions, people's stereotypes. One of the things you've said is, in order to be accepted as Muslims, we first need to be accepted as Americans. Don't put us in a box because of our religion. I'd like you to just explain a little bit what you mean by that. And also, in a sort of related question, it's really hard to get away from the headlines. So once again, you know, the Times Square bomber, terrorist, whatever you want to call that incident, how the challenges that presents to the Muslim American community, and just what your reaction and your responses to all of that.
Indeed, I mean, I think that, again, one of the things that's so important is Islam is a faith. It is not a scarf. It is not a specific attire. It's not how you wear your pants or how you don't wear your pants. I mean, Islam is, in essence, it's an internal spiritual connection. And with that said, I specifically always stress that, you know, don't put us in a box of religion, because, in essence, religion is self-identified. You are Muslim. Islam is as much about your intentions as it is your actions, and your intentions are known to no one other than your Creator. It's about how you treat people, how you interact with people, how you respect those around you. It's how you view the world in which you live, which are things that you cannot necessarily see visibly, but you can see through interaction. And that interaction requires, you know, personal, input from both sides. Interaction is a give and take. A dialogue is not let me talk and you listen, but it's let us mutually exchange and even if it leads to getting to a place where we agree to disagree. We have to ultimately be able to get to the stage where we can agree to disagree with respect and realize that people have many different narratives that define themselves. People have many different identities and labels in which they define themselves. And for someone on the outside to come and define me as a Muslim strips me from the power of saying, wait, I am also a woman. I am also young. I'm also a student. I'm also a sister. I'm also a daughter. You know, there's so many different ways that we self-identify. So I think that in saying, in also always qualifying, especially when you hear the term Muslim American, it's a sociological concept of hyphenization theory that says when you qualify, you know, the American, it in essence makes you less of an American in a way, in that you have to qualify what type of an American you are, versus using the term American to most people would trigger the thought of white Anglo-Saxon middle-aged person. And so I really try to move away from that, and I try to say that we are American who just so happen to be of a Muslim faith. We are American who can self-identify as Muslim if we want to, but we should not be instantly kind of boxed into this Muslim American or American Muslim category. And I say this not only to the, you know, external interfaith and intercultural community, but I say this as well to Muslims. And a big part of what I do is also community development and intra-faith dialogue, because I think in order to have quality interfaith dialogue, you must have quality intra-faith dialogue and understanding, which sadly is not really the case at this point in time. And so when I say to Muslim Americans is we need to engage beyond what quote-unquote Muslim issues are. What is a Muslim issue? And why is that every time an issue happens that has to do with the Muslim community, every Muslim feels the need to interact and engage? And I understand why. Because our community definitely sees themselves as constantly having to be apologetic, but then also help debunk misconceptions, which is very important, to help debunk misconceptions on a personal capacity. But I think that we should also be engaged in things that are much larger, that are beyond our community, that are American issues, because we are American. Issues like the healthcare debate, issues like running for office, issues like what's happening at the Boys and Girls Club or the senior center in your local cities. Those are as much Muslim issues as anything else is. And I think we really need to push and encourage more people to engage in larger activities, which is in essence exactly what Amin, the American Muslim Interactive Network, does, is it takes, and that's an organization that I founded in 07, but it takes Muslims and plugs them into Habitat for Humanity, into the soup kitchen, as concerned citizens, as Americans who care, not necessarily as Muslims, and Muslims have to give back, but these are people who are in an important part of the society, and in order to function in a healthy society, it requires positive contributions of everybody who exists within that society. So that's what we try to do through this kind of preach beyond the choir and idea that you have to engage in issues that are larger than just quote-unquote Muslim issues. And I actually witnessed, I witnessed something this last week which really caught me off guard, but it was after the Times Square, failed attempt bombing. I had posted something about the very racist video that Dan Finelli had written about racial profiling for his campaign for Congress, or actually for Senate in Florida. And I posted something on my Facebook status saying, this is unbelievable that this man actually, I thought it was a joke. He created a video that literally said, we should racially profile because this is what a terrorist looks like. And he literally had an Arab in his video. And he said, if this is what a terrorist looked like, and he showed this white, gray-haired man, he said, then I would encourage, to racially profile against this type of man. But this is not who bombs a plane. This is, and he pointed back to the Arab man. I just thought that was unbelievably, I was floored by it. So I posted something on my Facebook saying something to the effect of, this is not right. And one of my colleagues who I work with in the interfaith community posted a response, which I found very shocking. It caught me very much off guard. He says, I think it's very interesting. I always look and listen to all the things that you post. They're very provocative and great, because they try to build community and you're building peace rather than talking about negativity. He goes, but I'm very shocked by you and disheartened that you did not make a statement condemning what happened in New York City. And this really caught me off guard because I said, here I am doing all of this positive work for the community. And here I am engaging constantly in trying to make people realize that there's a whole slew of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans who are engaging positively. I don't feel the need to be apologetic for people who I do not think represent my faith, my community, or my mindset. And that's precisely, actually, I didn't even respond saying that. A few of people who were on my friends list actually responded to him saying, you know, if you're blinded by all what positive work, you know, she's doing and spending her time rather than talking about the work she's doing, but rather doing work, then we think that's really disheartening that you would actually take the time to write something like that. And I think that just says so much in and of itself.
I'd like to follow up on that. One of the things, you're right, that's so disheartening and troubling to hear when there's an attempted terrorist act, whether it's the underwear bomber at Christmas or the Fort Hood shooter in November or just this more recent incident in Times Square, is you do hear this sort of chorus of voices saying, why isn't the Muslim community condemning this? And first of all, they are. So if it's CARE or MPAC or whatever the organization might be, there's quick and fierce condemnation and very public condemnation that comes out. So number one, people aren't aware of that. But number two, this sense that every single person needs to stand up and apologize or condemn that in a way that, say, for instance, the Timothy McVeigh Oklahoma bombing or the guy who flew his plane into the IRS building doesn't require that same or doesn't prompt that same response from people. What do you say to that?
I think that's very disheartening to me. And actually, that was the exact argument that I recently gave someone who said, you know, terrorism is, you know, that Muslims do need to be apologetic for terrorism because it's a Muslim problem. And this was one of my colleagues who was from the Christian faith. And I said that, no, absolutely not. And I said, do you even know how the U.S. government defines terrorism? I mean, terrorism, if you look at the actual definition, according to our State Department, is the act of violence that, you know, affects innocent lives with a political motive. Now, exactly what you said, the IRS bombing and Timothy McVeigh, or the IRS failed plane crash, and the NRA, Timothy McVeigh, and all these things are, you know, politically motivated. And what about the abortion clinic bombings? And recently in D.C., a story that not many people heard about, but a woman who chopped, she had four children, she chopped their bodies into little pieces and froze them, and no one knew where they were. They went missing for a while. They finally found the social services found her children in the fridge, in the freezer, chopped into pieces. That God told me to do it. It was the sacrifice. Why did we not hear stories like her story? Why do we not hear all of these stories of people who are bombing abortion clinics or who are threatening, you know, to do things in the name of, quote-unquote, fundamentalist Christianity? And the man who had posted on my Facebook, you know, if that was the case, why does every Jew around the world not feel the need to be apologetic for the actions of people who are committing atrocities every single day in the name of Judaism overseas and that sort of thing? And these, to me, are larger issues that I think we need to speak out against, but we need to be very constructive and tiptoe around it to a certain way. But I don't want to be on the defensive when I come to this man and say, for example, I should not have to stand up and condemn, you know, violence of every person who, quote unquote, acts in the name of Islam. Because in saying that, then, you know, that will create a whole nother discussion that I probably do not want to engage with him about. And this is the reality of the matter. We keep saying we have freedom of speech, but we are also bound by what we say. And I think that we really need to acknowledge and recognize that what we say has larger implications. And although we are, quote unquote, this free country, and we do promote freedom of speech, it also comes with a price tag. And oftentimes it is constricting the civil rights and civil liberties of Muslim Americans who are actively engaged in these issues, because then people start questioning the larger motive. Well, why are these people engaged in, you know, standing up for X, Y, and Z, or, you know, promoting this agenda or that agenda? And this is a reality which is a sad reality, which is why I feel like a lot of Muslim Americans who would really be able to add a lot to the dialogue stay away from the dialogue, because there is this legitimate fear that, you know, our government says, come on, let's engage you, but we're still going to have the Patriot Act, and we still have racial profiling, and we still have these things that are seen as unjust and that limit and strip many people of their civil rights and civil liberties, like Guantanamo and these types of things. We have two wars in Afghanistan. and Iraq. So it's a complex problem. But I think that it is important for me to say to this guy and other people that say, why do Muslim Americans not stand up? You're right, they do. And they do very loudly. And they do in a way that is not, it's apologetic in the sense that it's saying we condemn, but it's not saying that this is, what Muslims do and we apologize on behalf of our faith. No, and I think that's very important, is that they're saying we do not associate with these people who are trying to, quote-unquote, hijack our faith. And I think that's a very important differentiation, is that they're not apologizing for the actions of these people, but they're saying that the actions of these people do not relate to my worldview, to my religion, to my perspective. So it's kind of, rather than being apologetic for it, it's distancing it from, the Muslim American mainstream community.
Right. You're very entrepreneurial yourself, and there are so many initiatives and organizations that you're involved in, that you've started, that you head, and one of them is the Iraqi Orphan Initiative that you're the executive director of. Tell us a little bit about that.
Wonderful. I tend to, because of the work I do in international diplomatic affairs and kind of cultural diplomacy, I tend to see many issues that are either not getting attention or not getting the right type of attention. And one of the issues that kept surfacing for me was this idea of Iraqi reconstruction. And you've heard so many people talk about refugees and orphans and widows. But the widows and the orphans received, a fair bit of attention, but it was mainly under the kind of auspice of this women's empowerment movement that the United States is interested in. So it's like, let's empower these widows who have all these children. And so as soon as I started hearing more and more of this rhetoric about widows and their orphans, I said, what about orphans who are orphaned by, Western standards, and that they do not have a mother and a father? And I didn't really know much about kind of adoption and orphans as it relates to the Islamic context, but then also as it relates to the Middle East. So I literally just started researching this by myself. I woke up in the middle of the night and I said, yeah, starting to think about this concept, I'm just going to get up and get to my laptop and start researching. So I started researching kind of adoption and orphans and statistics on orphans in Iraq, and I was bored with how little information actually exists on this topic, how little information exists about dialogue, sustainable dialogue about what the protocol should be for caring for an orphan in wartime in an Islamic-majority country or Muslim-majority country, like Iraq, like Afghanistan, specifically and especially because, war has led to so many fatalities and casualties, leaving so many of the people in Iraq vulnerable, and most of all the children who do not have the means to really talk about their stories. So I saw the orphans as even more disadvantaged than the widows, yet they were not getting the attention. So it started making me question, larger strategy for reconstruction in Iraq and what the funding sources were going to. And in doing more and more of this research, I started seeing issues of accountability. Accountability of foreign contractors working in Iraq, not just local contractors. I mean, how can you justify paying so much for security when you could use Iraqi people who are, dying for jobs for the same type of jobs? So I kind of took a really large step back and wanted to look at what the effect of having all this neglected population has, both short-term and long-term, both on the orphans, but then also on stability of Iraq, and then also national security, given the fact that you have 4.5 million children who are, quote-unquote, orphaned, and they have received such a tiny, if any, part of the budget in any type of reconstructive effort in Iraq. So it became my personal agenda to create an advocacy network that really provided, I call it, again, I use the word face again, but I call it the face of the voiceless, the Iraqi Orphan Initiative. And that really, what I'm trying to do is to create an advocacy network that puts a narrative to this very neglected portion of the Iraqi society and really pressures all the diverse stakeholders in Iraq to actually look at children as they relate to the reconstructive effort. Because there are so many problems that are coming out of this reality that are not addressed, trafficking being one of them, prostitution of children being one of them, suicide, escalating suicide rates, escalating rates of violence among children. There's just so many problems that are not really being addressed that relate to orphans. And I think that this is the type of dialogue that I'm aiming to achieve through convening diverse people, but then also doing advocacy, grassroots advocacy campaigns all around the country and all around the world. And I've already done a few that really say to people, hey, this is a big problem. This is a problem that is not a humanitarian crisis, but it's not only a humanitarian crisis, but it's also a national security crisis. Because what is the future of an Iraq that has 4.5 million disenfranchised people that have no voice? What type of a healthy community can you create with that statistic? And the fact that there is still a lot of statistics that no one knows. So that's in essence what the backdrop is for the Iraqi Orphan Initiative. And on a personal level, I'm really trying to encourage the Arab and Muslim communities, again, to take ownership of this problem and to say it is a Muslim problem. It is an Arab problem. It is a global problem. That this is not, oh, poor children in Iraq, but this is, we all need to provide a means to an end for these children who literally are stripped of nothing, and we're all to blame in essence. We are American. I am American, and America is the reason a lot of these children are orphaned. So I feel a personal responsibility to help be part of the solution.
You know, Hazami, you've lived all over the place in the work that you do that we've talked about a little bit. You've lived, you've been in many places around the world, in the United States. You've lived in Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Oregon, very, very different places. Can you talk a little bit about that experience of where you've worked and been and lived, and what some of the distinctions, surprising differences you've encountered, and what are some similarities that you've found no matter where you've been as well, if there are any?
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely. I mean, I actually have very much in the short span of my life, which I must say I am 26, because I know people always think I'm in my 30s, and it really makes my parents paranoid because they say, you know, people think you're a lot older than you are. This is why you're not getting married, which is an issue to all Arab parents and Muslim parents. I am 26, and had with traveling from such a young age, but then also parents who really pushed and promoted education and depth of thought have allowed me to achieve what I have achieved. Given, you know, most people think that, you know, a young age puts you at a disadvantage. At the contrary, I think it has given me so much energy. And it empowers me to say, if I can have achieved all of this with no backing, no financial backing, merely based on my ideas and my ability to constructively engage people around me because I can sell, in essence, my passion. And I'm not really selling it. I'm just talking about it so passionately that people feel motivated to say, oh, I want to join that. That a lot of people can do it. And it's not, you know, I'm not just blessed I am blessed, but I'm not just, you know, a person who managed to fall into this situation, but I created the situation. So I think traveling the world and living in so many diverse places allowed me to realize what and how I self-identify, but also my view of the world, and how views and perspectives are so relative to your circumstances. And you're defined, in essence, by your circumstances. And I think that really helps fuel and shape a lot of the work that I do, was because I realized from my travels that everybody has a reality, and that reality is real to them. And in essence, our reality are shaped by our personal circumstances, but they also dictate our actions and interactions. And that is really helpful because it allowed me to see that you cannot really delegitimize someone's narrative and perspective, because in essence, that is a reality. It's the essence of their being. So even for me, traveling to Mississippi and having lived in Mississippi, I was very much, everyone said, oh, everyone in the South is racist. Well, in me labeling them as racist, I am in essence doing what I am critiquing them from doing, which is labeling me as an Arab terrorist or as a Muslim terrorist. And so I really had to intentionally deconstruct my preconceived notions of the people that I interacted with and the communities that I interacted with. And because I was younger, I mean, I went to elementary school throughout the world, in the Middle East, in the UK, which is where I was born, in Manchester, England, and, you know, Boston, Massachusetts, Oregon, as you mentioned, Mississippi, Memphis, Saudi Arabia, and living family in Jordan and traveling extensively. It really forced me to step outside of how I self-identify and also give people a chance to get to know me on a personal level. But then also it forced me to talk in a language and to communicate in a way that they felt like I was not coming in from the outside and superimposing my views, but I sincerely cared to learn their diverse views. and in essence adopted some of that as my own to facilitate this discussion and to facilitate creating deeper bonds between me and the communities in which I was living. And I think that experience could not be taught. It cannot be learned about. It really has to be experienced. And I can never put a price tag on this type of perspective that my parents tirelessly worked to create for us, my brothers and I feel very fortunate for it. And I think that is, in essence, the importance of exchange programs. So the State Department talks about exchange programs, but I really value that interaction and exchange because I think it's so crucial in changing our paradigm of how not only how we perceive other people, but how we self-identify. And I think that actually is left out of a lot of this discussion is how you perceive yourself in society. How do you define yourself, your being? Because we do not live in a vacuum. And I think oftentimes we, in international exchange programs, we place emphasis on the exchange versus the self-discovery that enables quality exchange. And that's really, I would love to see a shift towards putting more emphasis on the person who's engaging in that exchange, not just the exchange to know itself. Because you can be in the middle of Uganda and be there with this ethnocentric mentality and not get the same experience as someone who is there saying, you know, I may not be familiar with a society, but I'm going to put my conscious effort into not, you know, trying to superimpose my opinion. But I think acknowledging that we have our preconceived notions and that we are all biased by nature of being is very important to creating a fruitful discussion. So something I was able to learn at a very young age merely by living the experience. And we talked about international experiences. Again, I think my abilities to have lived in Boston and Oregon and then Mississippi in and of themselves created an amazing view and vision for the United States because we often don't realize that there's America beyond, you know, New York and D.C. and Chicago and California. But there's an America that exists, you know, in the South and in the West that is very darn tapped in, and we don't really exchange much internally within the United States. But I always joke with my friends in D.C. and I have an exchange program and bring someone from, you know, Mississippi to D.C. and vice versa because I think that is more of a reality shock than, you know, some people going overseas.
Sure, that's true. Hasami, I have one last question for you, and that's in all the work you do, as you look ahead to the coming, you know, days and weeks and years, what do you think some of the biggest challenges facing us are? And despite or including all of that, what is it that gives you hope?
I think one of the biggest challenges that faces me personally is sleep, lack of sleep. you know, I think that in moving, you know, looking forward, I'm so passionate about building collective visions of people and building networks that engage very diverse people with very similar aspirations and hopes. There is not one face to an activist. There is not one face to a global citizen. And there's not one field. I mean, we often look at just international business or international diplomacy or international affairs. But an IT engineer is just as much capable of creating long-term international impact as a person who works in the soup kitchen, as someone who creates fabric. I mean, we all have a place, an important place, and we should find ways to engage people who may be able to bring diverse talents and skill sets to the table that are not currently represented. So in looking forward, I'm personally very happy to see a shift in engaging more diverse audiences and finding means to create larger dialogue that extends beyond just A to B, but, you know, seeing that A may not lead to B, but it may lead to all these other things that do not necessarily make the outcome of this dialogue not successful, but there are all these other things that we may not have thought about, that we may not have considered. And you know, I always say work, people need to remove the blinders off their work, because in saying that you're going to do this, that's going to lead to that, that's going to lead to that, you're in essence channeling and marginalizing all the other opportunities and all the other ways to get to your end point that can, you know, be a lot more constructive or be better than anything you had ever envisioned. So living day by day, but then also figuring out a way to not channel yourself in your own work, I think are some of the biggest challenges that we as people who are working in these areas face. And then also, you know, how we can really engage preach beyond the choir? I mean, what does that really look like? How can we ever create opportunities and platforms for even Muslims, if you look within the Muslim community, for the most, quote-unquote, liberal to the most, quote-unquote, conservative Muslims to find a platform where they can have a healthy discussion and, you know, based on a mutual exchange? I mean, ultimately, that is what success looks like in my books. It's about having people who have unbelievably diverse extreme views that are probably going to walk away with those extreme diverse views they came with, but still feel like, you know, they are just as entitled to their views as I am entitled to mine. I think that that's what I'm striving for personally, and it I get a lot of hope from seeing how many people are really global citizens and how many people, when you give them the right leadership, the right tools, the right resources, and hope, actually feel like they can be a part of the change. They can be a part of constructive development for their own communities. And in essence, that is the very core of what El Mubadara, the Arab Empowerment Initiative, aims to do. It aims to empower Arabs around the world to say, I matter. I have a story. I have a narrative, and I can contribute positively in whatever way it is. But I'm a being that also has a place in society. And I think that that's ultimately what I think gives me hope, is seeing more and more people feeling like they are something, and they mean something to not only their fields, but then to also larger, healthier communities globally that affect us all.
Thank you so much, Hazami. This has been very informative, enlightening, insightful, and enjoyable. Thanks so much for giving us your time.
Thank you so very much.